from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on October 12th, when a caravan of roughly 5,000 people departed Honduras. They were fleeing a city called San Pedro Sula, ridden by crime. In roughly three and a half weeks, they have finally reached Mexico City, still a long way from the U.S. border. They will meet armed resistance when they arrive on the doorstep of the United States. President Trump has ordered thousands of servicemen and women to defend the border from what he calls an invasion. And now the Washington Post reports that gun-carrying civilian groups and border vigilantes have listened to President Trump's warnings and decided to head to the border to offer a kind of vigilante armed resistance of their own against the caravan. More than 100 modern militia men and women are on their way to the Rio Grande right now. They're packing weapons along with coolers and tents, even aerial drones. The group's leader was asked whether they'll be ready to deploy weapons against the migrant caravan. He laughed and told the Washington Post, quote, "This is Texas, man." Well, tonight, the Rochester chapter of the World Affairs Council has brought in a former ambassador with many years of experience. He will talk about the Honduran caravan, but also what we might call the new NAFTA, USMCA, and trade relations with Mexico. His name is Earl Anthony Wayne, and his long resume includes time as ambassador to Mexico, former assistant secretary of state for economic and business affairs, ambassador to Argentina, and more. He serves as a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and co-chair of the Mexico Institute Board. Ambassador Wayne, great to have you. Thank you for being here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And I want to be very clear with our listeners right off the top. It is Election Day, as I said last hour, and I will say it again this hour. The goal of this conversation is not to be overtly political. We have to wade into some things that have become a little bit political. But Ambassador Wayne is not doing work in a partisan nature that I've understand. I've read a lot of your work. I've seen a lot of your speeches. I haven't seen a partisan tinge to your work.
No, exactly. And in fact, the Wilson Center is pledged to be nonpartisan in its analysis and its examination of problems around the world.
All right. So just understand, listeners, that we're going to have to try to deal with the reality in certain places and in certain circumstances. The goal is not to be partisan or political. But let's start with the caravan, and I know listeners have a lot of questions about that. So October 12th, this caravan of, again, roughly 5,000 people heads out from a place that a lot of people fleeing their own countries, it's a circumstance that's pretty similar or familiar. There's violence. They're looking for a way out of that. Similar here?
Yes. Since 2013, 2014, there's been these periodic outflows from the northern three countries of Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador, driven in part by violence and criminality, driven in part by poverty also, and people just looking for a better life. And this is the latest of those caravans, of which there have been many. This one apparently started with some critics of the Honduran government trying to embarrass the government of Honduras by offering that people have to leave Honduras to find a better life. A lot of Hondurans saw this as an opportunity to have safety in numbers, to be able to leave in a way that they wouldn't have to pay smugglers, to be protected along the way and head north to what they clearly see for various reasons as a much better life possibility in the United States.
When you have 5,000 people, there's not any one single, quote, type of person or age. In fact, it runs a wide gamut in terms of ages, newborns all the way up to elderly people in the caravan. But generally speaking, do we know of people smuggling drugs, heavily armed, from other parts of the world infiltrating the caravan as a way of sort of infiltrating the United States?
No. And there's been very intense media coverage of this caravan every day, practically, and a lot of television footage and others. And there are young kids who left their own families to go on their own. There are family units. There are young men, and you don't know their background. But when they're being interviewed on television, either with in U.S. TV or Mexican TV that I've seen also, they basically say, we're just looking for a better life here. And that certainly raises legitimate problems that need to be solved. Do we really, as the United States, just want to have these unregulated flows coming? No, probably not. But it's not that they are coming as a threat to the United States in any near-term sense. They are just a representative of a major problem that needs to be dealt with across the whole region.
Yeah, I think that's probably where the distraction takes us away from. And you cannot bifurcate the response to the caravan as, well, everyone either wants to let them all in and do whatever they want, or we need to have armed guards at the border shooting them if they cross in. It's obviously not that simple. We have a problem at the southern border because there are problems in neighboring countries where people are fleeing drugs and violence and lack of opportunity. And no one, I think, denies that the system and the entire sort of framework of governments has to be better in some sense. But are we distracted when we literally are looking at our own armed soldiers and now these sort of vigilante militias? And should we be concerned about a kind of a worst case scenario of bloodshed down there? Are you worried about that?
Well, something could always happen. But my hunch is that the federal forces actually on the border, which will be Homeland Security forces to engage, are probably being well drilled to avoid that kind of violence. But what you are correct that what we should be looking at is how can we even take this situation and turn it into a way to build better regional coordination between the U.S., Mexico, the Central American countries. That is looking at each phase of this problem, looking at how can we do better with the root causes that are driving people out from Central America. How can we better care for these people along the way? Because over the last 5 years, many of them have been abused by criminals, by corrupt officials, as they've tried to get to the United States. In fact, some estimates are that organized groups make over $1 billion a year helping smuggle these people northward. Third, certainly we should have controls at our border, and we should hopefully be able to have a filtering before they get to the border. And there will be some who have legitimate claims to asylum as defined by international regulations, that they have real fear of being prosecuted or persecuted if they go back home. But there need to be steps that you can deal with this in a gradual way. Now, that doesn't at all mean that you let everybody in. And then we have our own challenges on the border where, as you know, and you've probably talked about, we have long delays in considering the cases who come to the United States and individuals seek asylum. We have a shortage of judges that have in the past led to 2-3 year delays.
Now, just as some listeners say, well, you know, you're too hard on what generally is the political right who is concerned about this caravan. And again, we're not trying to make this about partisanship. But I think it's fair to point out that generally the political left are the ones I see saying, look, all of them, they're not even doing anything illegal. They're all going to apply for asylum. And I think there may be a lack of understanding about what asylum means and when it's sort of appropriate. Can you touch a little bit on that?
Well, there are a number of international accords in which everybody, including the United States, signed up and said, if somebody arrives at your border on your territory and says, if I go home, I'm going to be persecuted, or I'm going to be killed, or I'm going to be taken hostage or tortured, you need to consider that claim. And if there's validity to it, you agree to accept them. And we have accepted them for decades now. We've accepted this principle. And so have other countries around the world. So then there are others who come and say that they're going to be persecuted, but they really just want a better job. And you can be sympathetic with them, and they want a better life, but that doesn't give them the status to become a recognized refugee if it's international, or to asylum seeker if in the country that they where they are. So it's not an easy process to sort through, but we have a series of adjudication processes in the United States that are supposed to address that. One of the problems is those resources are not sufficient for the number of people that have been coming to the U.S., which leads to these delays. Also, there's not a process, let's say, on the way coming to the United States. In Mexico, very limited capacity to take care of refugees, to protect people, to look at their legitimate claims. So one of the things they've done recently is they've asked for the UN Refugee Agency to help them interview these people and to see who's a legitimate refugee asylum seeker and who isn't. They've also, very interestingly, offered temporary work permits to people if they want to, if they can stay in Mexico, in southern Mexico particularly. And the new incoming president of Mexico has said, I'm willing to offer work visas to these people to come and work because we can use them. We need them.
So despite some of the hot rhetoric, your expectation is we're not going to see a bloodshed sort of confrontation at the southern border.
Well, I certainly think that's what all the authorities on both sides of the border are going to be working toward. You can never say that something bad might not happen, but I don't think so, and I know that all the preparation is being put into avoiding that kind of an outcome.
Has the presence of the election changed some of the rhetoric?
I think yes, it has. That certainly this has become a topic that people are using to try to motivate their supporters to come out. But that's why in what I've been saying and some of the things I've been writing, I think we should use this as an opportunity to build a basis for better coordination and cooperation to manage this problem over the longer term. And we have a real possibility now with Mexico to do this. They're in the middle of their transition to a new president.
How much confidence do you have in their new leadership?
Well, I think on this issue, the new leadership, on the one hand, is committed to the rights of migrants, to protecting them, their human rights, making sure they aren't abused. On the other hand, their proposal is, well, we really have to look at the root causes here, and that means creating through development and other programs jobs for these people, as well as dealing with the criminal gangs that are threatening so many of them. And this, of course, happens in Mexico, too. And we really have to deal with it at all these different levels. So I think there's an opening to do that. It's not going to get fixed overnight. There's no question about that. But if we can get a modus vivendi with this new government in Mexico, I think we can have a way to move forward that takes you beyond the crisis of caravan, next caravan, the one after that, and really starts dealing with this program in a way that's going to eliminate eventually and reduce significantly the flows.
The root causes, right? And so I wonder then if you agree with the critics who say, look, you can try to enforce the border, you can try to go after gangs, but what you are doing is you are attacking symptoms of a problem that will always be there in some form. And so the most effective way to change the migration situation is to create more stable societies. But what power do we have as the United States to either do that in Mexico or in other nations where we see a lot of out-migration? Do we have much of a role? So do you agree with that diagnosis? And then do you agree that we're a little bit impotent to deal very much with those root causes?
I do agree with the diagnosis. I also agree that fixing those problems is going to take a long time. So that's why you need a combination of working on fixing the long problems, on dealing with the human needs of these individuals right now, and not getting overwhelmed at your own border. And I think the way to do that is to work very closely with the countries between where these migrants first start out and when they get to the United States. And it might mean having different processes on the way that you can judge, look at legitimate claims, or tell people you don't have a legitimate claim.
Of asylum.
Mm-hmm. But it has to be done in an open, fair, transparent way also. And I think we can do that. And I think it's really important to remember that in the world, there are well over 20 million people on the move. This is not just happening here. In fact, it's happening less here than it's been happening in Africa and from the Middle East flowing into Europe, where the numbers have been much greater. And very sadly, the number of deaths along the way have been much, much higher. So this is happening all over. And it doesn't mean we have to solve all of that, but it is important to recognize that it's part of a broader phenomena, and it doesn't get solved just by enforcement actions alone. Enforcement has to be part of the solution, no question about that.
My guest for the hour is Ambassador Earl Anthony Wayne, who spent a number of years serving our federal government in various capacities. His work took him to Mexico as ambassador of Mexico. He's been ambassador to Argentina, former assistant secretary of state for economic and business affairs, and he serves now as a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and co-chair of the Mexico Institute board. Let me take our first phone call of the hour, and this is Scott calling from Prattsburg. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you for taking my call, Evan. First of all, how much time do I have?
Not the rest of the hour, but you got some time.
I wouldn't dare do that.
Go ahead.
One comment, and it's just overlapping from your prior show. It's amazing how things overlap. And I was thinking of the theme of fear. And I just want to add, too, I'm a huge fan of Rush Read Library. And if you ever happen to go there, they do have that on the second floor. But if you go down to the basement, way down, there's several different floors, you will find some history that I don't even think is on the Internet that someone could find. It's absolutely fascinating and very educational, but spooky, very spooky down there. But my comment, and that's like I said, I want to be nonpartisan, by the way. Please tell me if
it's the theme
like
of the day.
The wrong...
No, it's okay. It's okay.
I mean,
go
it's
ahead.
A political topic to begin with.
It, to some degree, it is. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And my thought might be really out of the box here, but instead of meeting those immigrants with guns and barbed wire, why not greet them with bulldozers, backhoes, and excavators? Build them a factory and a start of a new community on the south side where that wall would be. I wrote this before because I was afraid I'd lose my train of thought.
It's okay.
And finance it with 50% of what the wall would cost and build the armed military presence for Border Patrol, put that all together and just charge 50% of it. Recruit the militia that's there right now and have them, instead of walking around with firearms, ask them to roll up their sleeves and use that barbed wire for a corral for cattle. Maybe dull it a little bit because you don't want to scar prime beef, not with razor wire. And help with the construction of a new community. Perhaps a liberal or Democratic or Republican approach, you can decide on that.
But, okay.
Our country was started with immigration from all walks of life. And actually, sir, I can trace my generation to the first generation. My uncle, our great-great-great-grandfather landed in Philadelphia in 1774. And, you know, he had a mission when he got there. I mean, he probably got recruited by somebody when he first got there to fight. But, you know, think about this for a little bit, and it just correlates what the retired ambassador talked about. They're coming across the border now saying they want asylum or they want work. But if you take, like, for example, when they came over from Europe into New York, I think the only two English words they knew was Endicott Johnson. And they were looking for work, and they found work. And my guess is when that was full, they migrated up to Rochester because they had a lot of that going on up there as well.
Well, Scott, let me just jump in. You've given us a lot here, and I always appreciate the call. Thank you for taking the time to call. And let me just turn over to Ambassador Wayne there. So, you know, there's going to be people who hear Scott's call and say, that's not our responsibility. You don't have to build a factory at the southern border. That's not our responsibility. Scott's saying, if we did that, it'd be better for them than putting up a wall. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there is a lot in the idea of helping to create jobs and livelihoods for people. In fact, the new president of Mexico, in his first letter to President Trump and then in a follow-up phone call, said, look, let's have a joint development plan that looks at Central America and the southern part of Mexico, and let's see if we can help create jobs for people so they don't feel they have to migrate. And then let's put part of this into also better enforcement, better border security, better police forces, better treatment of people. Let's do this all together. So this is an interesting offer he has to work with us, which includes, as I mentioned earlier, giving temporary work visas to Central Americans so they'll come and work in Mexico. It's also important, I think, to look at the history of Mexico and the United States and what's happened. There's right now, over the past 10 years, there's been a net outflow of Mexicans in the United States without documentation back to Mexico. And there's actually been more and more going home than coming here. Why is that? Well, there are job opportunities back there. There's a lot of there's family back there. When I was ambassador and we saw some of the surveys of these people, he said, well, why are you going home? They said, well, we really never wanted to stay in the United States. We just wanted work to have some money to send for our families. And now we've decided we want to go home, be with those families. We have enough income that we've made over these years in the United States. So I think there is a lot to be done in looking at different job creation possibilities and also temporary worker possibilities. For example, Mexico and Canada have a program of temporary seasonal work that's been going on without any problem now for a number of years, where people go up, they work a season, they come back, go back to Mexico, they come back again the next year, meeting needs in Canada of the farmers but other service people, but also then helping provide funds to some of these underpoverished areas and not creating social problems. So there are different options we could explore along those lines as part of a broader, a global solution to deal with this challenge.
All right, let me get Andrew and Irondequoit next on the phone. Go ahead, Andrew.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. My idea is they could legitimately have a revolution in those countries like Honduras and El Salvador. If the government is being bought off by the drug cartels, it would be perfectly legitimate to have a forcible revolution where they take their country back and have a legitimate democracy. What do you think?
That certainly has been is an option. There have been a lot of turnovers in those countries during the years. One of the big problems, though, is just lack of capacity and just poor governing. Even if they're not, if this isn't a government that's run by a drug cartel, they just aren't efficiently dealing with the problems that they face.
Do they have a real democracy, though, is my question.
Well, they have a participatory system in which they get to vote for people.
Okay.
How you define if that's a full-fledged democracy. You'd have to go into each one and look at them. But part of the challenge also is that building more effective institutions, better space for businesses is hard to do. They would very much benefit from additional support from the United States and others in just getting this done. We have started doing that, and there are some pretty significant programs there to help strengthen police forces and others. And we've seen big changes in certain communities where this aid has been focused over the past several years, where security has indeed been restored. But you're doing it one community at a time. It's a long-term effort. And it's probably going to take significant investment and commitment. You're exactly right in what you're saying, commitment from the local authorities, from the local people to get this done.
Like the idea of an armed, revolution. But if it's an illegitimate government, like a government run by the drug cartel, I would support that.
Well,
is what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I understand. And one of the big challenges that people have been trying to work on is fighting corruption in these places, because as you know, if there's money to be paid in poor countries and also the threat of violence, corruption expands. Gets worse. In Mexico, it's a major challenge also that they're trying to grapple with and get a hold of.
Anything else you want to add, Andrew?
Well, it's just a bad situation. I wish that. The optics of this caravan are just awful, just awful. It's, of course, we can absorb 7,000 Hondurans, but the optics, and it's so easy for the political sides to it's low-hanging fruit for political ads and stuff. I mean, it's just terrible. The whole situation's terrible.
Well, and Andrew, thank you. You want to add to that, Ambassador?
No, I agree fully, and that's why we should try to take advantage of this to get real momentum moving toward a sustainable solution over the longer term and not just treat it as a case-by-case crisis.
Amy writes to us and says, Evan, if your wife, kids, and other family members were being robbed, kidnapped, and raped by gang members on a regular basis, I think most people would find a safer place to live. I'm fortunate to have met a beautiful family from Honduras. I was able to hear their story, and their only desire is to live in a safe place. Until you're in a situation like that, how do you know what you would do? That's from Amy.
Yeah, no,
it's
Amy,
impossible to argue that.
No, Amy is right in her observation. Yeah. I remember in 2014 when the first wave of these families came, I couldn't understand why families were sending their 12 and 13, 14-year-olds by themselves to try to get to the United States. And then I saw the results of all the interviews by the U.S. authorities on the border of people, and I came to understand that they were fleeing because life where they were was so scary, so threatening. And that's why you have to help. You have to help your neighbor in that sense and provide them spaces along the way that they can be safe. Doesn't necessarily mean we have to let them all into the United States, but there is some shared responsibility here to just care for these people as humans.
Well, Ambassador Wayne, you mentioned on November 2nd, I think, you wrote about what, in your words, was a superb Brookings panel on the costs of migration. And just, I think that subject alone is worth exploring a little bit with you, because there is, again, as these things tend to get divided into either left or right or sort of one side or the other, this notion of migration being good, migration being a net negative. You wrote the following. You said, the cost of migration, the panel argues that migrants are an overall plus. They cite American Academy of Sciences study with the average net plus of $259,000 per immigrant. But what do you mean by that?
Well, that's an average, of course, looking across the whole economy. And you're exactly right that migration has all sorts of different layers to it. On the one hand, one out of every 3.5 inventors in the United States was born in another country. We get a tremendous benefit from these high achievers, the entrepreneurs that come in because they see this as an environment in the U.S. where their ideas can flourish, where they can build companies, where they can study and invent. If you look at the number of Nobel Prize winners in the sciences from the United States, a tremendously high percentage of them were foreign-born. So that's a tremendous plus. So that raises that average, right? There's no question about that. But at the other end of the spectrum, there are sectors of the U.S. economy where there are jobs that Americans don't want to do. And those sectors could greatly benefit by having a regularized program, not an uncontrolled program, but a regular program where people can come, work for a while, then go back to their home countries. We have a limited program like that with Mexico. As I mentioned, Mexico and Canada have a bigger program relative to their economies. We could do that. But part of the challenge has been that our political leadership for decades, so not one party or the other, has not been able to reach an agreement on reforming our immigration laws. And is, I think the last reform was during the Reagan years. So that's a long time ago, 1980s, less comprehensive reform. There have been some smaller changes. But there's a lot of change that could be very good for the economy of the United States if we could get consensus to get it done. And so I've said privately for a long time when I was a government official and publicly since, it's really important that we try and get to a consensus on a really rational approach to looking at all the different aspects of immigration and migration. There's no question that unregulated flows are not in anybody's interest because you don't know who's coming and going. In fact, more illegal immigration has come in through our normal ports, not across the southern border, but visitors coming and then overstaying their visas, rather than illegal crossing of the border in the last several years in the United States. So this is a much bigger challenge, But it's important to recognize that if we get it right, there are big benefits for our society at the same time.
Okay. And before we move on to talk about what we would call the USMCA, the new NAFTA, in our second half hour, you touch on some possible solutions as you see them, some remedies. But what's one or two that stand out to you that says maybe not in today's political climate, or maybe something is within reach, that if we were to do X, Y, and Z, this is a big start to really reforming immigration in the way you think is logical?
One is I'd set up a layered approach to this Central American migration, working in the source countries, working with Mexico, and then working at our border. Two, I would consider a temporary worker program for certain limited, carefully defined categories that could look at Central Americans and maybe some Mexicans, too. I don't know that would be a benefit to the United States. Secondly, I would hope we could get to a consensus on a sensible reform of our immigration policy. I think we have big advantages that we could gain as a society, as innovators, creating prosperity, if we could get this right and be part of our competitiveness plan as a country.
Gary writes to us and says, just as quantum mechanics and Newtonian physics are inconsistent at the micro and macro levels, so is this situation. At the micro level, we can be sympathetic. But at the macro level, no nation can sustain an open border with no rule of law. We could end up killing ourselves with kindness. The answer is stabilizing the countries in question. Do we now need to be cruel to be kind? Can we look to the past as a rule for the present?
I think we need to be comprehensive, and that means we need to enforce our laws. We need to deal with the problems in the source countries, and we need to have good, just humanitarian treatment of people along the way. And I think by looking at all three of those things, we can do just what he's written there.
Don writes to us and says, Ambassador Wayne, there's been a lot of talk about dreamers in the United States. What does Mexico do with their dreamers from Central America?
They're increasingly recognizing they have this problem. One of the interesting things when I was in Mexico that I observed is traditionally they had been a source country for migrants, all headed to the United States. They hadn't realized that they were becoming a transit country. As more Mexicans were coming back from the United States, they created more jobs. They've become more modern parts of their society. They've also realized that they have these additional responsibilities, and they need to think about migration in a different way. They're still very sympathetic to the Central Americans, but they're starting to realize that, yes, it's not in their interest either to not know who's in their country, how many came in, where they're going, what they're doing. They're also trying to sort through how can they be more sensible about this. And I think a big part of the burden is going to fall on this new government that's taking office starting December 1st.
Are they more strict, in other words? Are they tightening who is allowed or sort of monitoring?
One of the important things to remember is that over the past 5 years or so, the Mexicans have sent about 500,000 people back to Central America. Those people would have showed up on our border if they hadn't been sent back. So that is an evolution and a change. It doesn't mean, as I said, however, that they aren't sympathetic to these people. They are very sympathetic to them, but they realize that they also need to have a more regularized approach to this, giving these people visas, having them registered, knowing where they are. They are happy to try to create some work for them where there is need, but their capacities are also not very strong. They don't have strong institutions in the south of their country. Their border is largely open in the south of their country. They've been taking steps to build better facilities, to train people, but it's a big challenge for them too.
All right, my guest for the hour is Ambassador Earl Anthony Wayne, who is in Rochester as a guest of the World Affairs Council's Rochester chapter. He's speaking tonight at an event that their events are always pretty much sold out and filled up. But if you want to get in touch with them, you can email me, edawson@wxxi.org. I'll put you in touch, and they'll decide if they want to bring you in the future. They're not that shadowy. They're actually really nice people. Ambassador Wayne has a long history of experience serving our federal government. He was ambassador to Mexico, ambassador to Argentina, former assistant secretary of state for economic and business affairs, And that doesn't even touch on the work that he's done in other parts of the world. But now he's a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and co-chair of the Mexico Institute Board. Let's get our only short break of the hour, and we'll talk about the new NAFTA next. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the Next Connections, it's a look back at Election Day. The big stories, the winners, those who did not win, will be joined by political candidates who were victorious on election night, and we'll have a chance to have our audience respond to the developments of Election Day. Join us starting at noon on Wednesday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. You can call it the new NAFTA, NAFTA 2.0. The president calls it the USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement. He disliked NAFTA so much he wanted a different name. And I want to read from Paul Wiseman's story in the Associated Press on the USMCA. Under the title, NAFTA 2.0 could draw some jobs back to the United States, but at what cost? Quote, President Donald Trump insists that his new North American trade deal will deliver a victory for U.S. factory workers by returning many high-paying jobs to the United States. But a review of the agreement suggests that it could also mean higher prices for consumers and more inefficiencies for businesses. And the biggest winners might end up being robots and the companies that make them. Michael McAdoo of the Boston Consulting Group said that it's going to be harder to keep North America competitive as a manufacturing hub. And what's more, much of the manufacturing work that does return to the United States would likely be done by robots in America's increasingly automated plants, not by human workers. End quote. What do you make of that analysis from the Associated Press, Ambassador?
Well, I think these are the questions that we really need to seriously look at as we move to have congressional ratification of this new agreement. But first, I think it's really important just to realize how much is riding on what used to be called NAFTA and is now called USMCA or T-MEC, as they call it in Mexico.
T-MEC, okay.
About 14 million U.S. jobs that are supported by this trade that goes on. That's about $1.3 trillion of trade every minute. So if you think about a minute, each minute there's $1 million of trade between the U.S. and Mexico and $1.2 or $1.3 million with Canada. So this trade is going on all the time. Over the past 25 years, what's happened is the private sector, not the governments, have built this network where we build things together across North America. And NAFTA has always been criticized all along the way, but people really haven't appreciated that it's actually created a lot of jobs. When we started NAFTA, it was estimated about 700,000 jobs in the U.S. depended on trade with Mexico. 2015, that was 4.9 million jobs. So this trade, this investment that we've all put into the three countries has just made this tremendously important. Our two largest clients in the world, the two largest countries that buy the most from us, are Canada and Mexico. So this is a big deal. There are questions about the new agreement. But the biggest plus is that it keeps this production network, which has made the United States more competitive in the world against China and against others, has kept that together and is going to allow that to go forward. But we do need to look carefully at the issues raised in that AP article, which is a very good one because it flags what you need to really ask about and look at. And that's because some of the biggest changes in this new agreement are changing something really complicated called rules of origin. But it's basically, if you think about a car, what makes that a North American car?
Sure.
How much of that car has to be made up of labor and parts from the United States, Canada, and Mexico to count as a U.S. car, not as a Japanese car? So, for example, a Honda CR-V put together in Guadalajara, Mexico, actually has 70% of its content from Canada and the United States, 30% from Mexico, and not very much from Japan, because it's all, I mean, the design and the intellectual property is from Japan, but it's built in North America. Same thing for GM cars, Ford cars. Of course, they have very high levels of North American content. But if you're importing a car directly from Europe or from Korea or directly from Japan, it wouldn't qualify. So you wouldn't be duty-free. You'd have to pay tariffs on that. This is the biggest change, and that's what this article is saying. We have to look at these new rules very carefully. Has raising the level of content from North America, has one of the provisions that says 40% of the content of a car has to be made by a worker making $16 an hour or more, is that going to raise the prices significantly for American consumers, but also for places around the world that have been buying from the United States? Are our cars still going to be competitive? Or, as the implication is here, in order to make this production now more cost competitive, will they just use more and more technology? And sure, they'll have well-placed workers, but fewer of those. And that's been the general trend in manufacturing since the early 1990s, reducing the number of workers, increasing technology.
Automation.
And the result has been higher productivity per hour and the highest productivity we've ever had in our auto industry, but with less.
Fewer workers, right?
Fewer workers.
So is there any meaningful way to sort of blunt the advance of automation, Ambassador? And I'm talking about in the case of the new NAFTA, but I'm also talking about in sectors around the world here. I mean, I read a piece that you shared with your readers from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, defining the future of work before it defines us, and talking about the International Labor Organization that needs to be visionary again to protect the conditions and rights and work of workers around the world. But every time we seem to see pressure to bring wages up, we now have that pressure to automize. And I don't know what to do about that. Do you?
Well, part of what I've argued is that we need to invest in workforce development a lot more heavily than we have. And the we, I mean, the private sector and governments together. And that means building into the business model more regular education throughout a career, and making that just part of how you do business, what your public investment is and what the private sector companies are doing. If you don't do that, more workers are going to get left behind. And it may, in fact, hurt the competitiveness of the whole country. But if you do it in a smart way, where you get this virtuous cycle of re-educating people as new technology comes in and having people come out of either high school, community college, or universities with ever-evolving education to fit the new skills that are needed, you can have good outcomes. And I think that's what we do. We need to change our mindset of how we look at what the workplace is, what work is, and how we're going to approach work. And that means it's work for everybody. The individual worker is going to just have to accept, I'm going to have to learn new skills every 5 years. But also, if the CEOs have to build in to their cost, I need to retrain these workers, and it's in my interest to do so because I'll be more competitive as this goes forward.
Is there a public sector component to that? In other words, if I'm a CEO, am I going to say, look, to the government, you want a better society, you need to pitch in for retraining too?
They do. I think that governments need to budget for support for retraining along the way, and that part of that is a public expense. It's a public interest because it's going to make the whole society more productive as we go forward. If we don't do this, we're going to be headed toward really tough times with these waves of new technology.
I also want to ask you, Ambassador, about NAFTA and how a lot of Americans have come to look at it. And you know, Americans don't obviously study the details of NAFTA, but they know about it in broad outlines, including this characterization from that same piece by Paul Wiseman in the Associated Press. Quote, NAFTA had erased most trade barriers separating the United States, Canada, and Mexico. Trade among the three surged, but many U.S. manufacturers moved factories and jobs to Mexico to capitalize on cheaper labor. Those manufacturers could then ship cars and other goods back to the United States and Canada duty-free. President Trump demanded a new deal more favorable to American workers. End quote. Oversimplification or fair?
Oversimplification. If you actually look at the economic studies that were done on this, what you find is that more jobs were created in the United States to replace many of those jobs that moved to Mexico. Jobs did go to Mexico, but they were replaced with higher skilled jobs in the United States, often in other parts of the country. So those communities that lost those manufacturing jobs didn't get them back. That is a problem. But NAFTA itself did not actually drain most jobs away. In fact, the studies that have looked at where the jobs went have targeted Chinese trade and technology, automation, not NAFTA. NAFTA is sort of a blip on this, but it became the symbol for all that was going on in globalization and loss of jobs. And that's because we were not investing in our human capital, in that workforce. We weren't helping them find new jobs, helping them be retrained, helping them find new opportunities when those factories did move. And they didn't just move to Mexico. They moved to the southern United States. They moved to Texas. They moved to other places too. It was a real economic transformation. And that's why we have to look at this, because it's going to continue.
So in other words, those communities that have lost their factories, that have hollowed out, that in many places are hubs of the opioid crisis today, are real. And those are real problems, and in some cases, a real result of NAFTA. We could have done a better job saying, look, you're going to lose that factory. What are we going to do for this community collectively? But meanwhile, the argument that you seem to be making is those are easy communities to target, to put the pictures out, to tell the story. But the larger story is an actual synergy in NAFTA and more net jobs here.
Yes.
Here, too.
That here, too, in the United States, too.
But we had to help those communities that got hammered, and we didn't do it.
It was a public policy failure by both parties. It's a bipartisan failure.
Okay.
We did not look at that. But the interesting thing is, if you look at NAFTA itself, the opinion of NAFTA itself over the past several years, mm-hmm. 2008, only about 42% of everybody thought NAFTA was a good thing. 2018, the average is 63%. Thought it was good. People, because of the debate over the past 2 years, have started understanding NAFTA is bigger than we thought it was. They don't know all the details, but they do know, gee, there's a lot of jobs here. There are a lot of farmers that sell things to Canada and Mexico, and that's good for them too.
All right, one more quick question, and it's Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. It seems like the two issues are related. You're talking about, you know, waves of immigration coming from Central America into the U.S., and those people, for the most part, are poorly skilled. They don't have skills that are really skills that the United States really needs. And at the same time, you know, you're talking about retraining people because the jobs are moving elsewhere. It just seems like they seem to be moving in opposite directions, and there doesn't seem to be any coordination between the two. The other point with this is that if you look at, you know, globally income, you got, you know, you're looking at over 700 million people around the world that live on less than $1.90 a day. We can't take them all in as economic refugees. It just seems like the immigration policy needs to be restructured to try to attract people that we need skill-wise versus just letting anyone in that, you know, are going to be immediately in a situation where they have to be retrained for jobs that don't exist.
Robert, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Ambassador.
Robert, I couldn't agree with you more. We need to retune our immigration policy. There are spaces for some people in dire human need that we should take in, but you're right. We should be focused on what our society needs, and we should help other countries to solve their own problems, but we shouldn't become the refuge for everybody. On the migrants, one of the you're talking about two ends of that migration spectrum. Remember, we want high-skilled, thoughtful, inventive migrants to come. That's good. But there are also some sectors where we do need low-skilled people because Americans don't want to do those jobs. We just need it in a very regulated, monitored way, so both they're protected, but then our sectors benefit, and it doesn't create a large burden in the long run on our country.
Should we have ever separated children from their parents at the southern border?
That wouldn't have been my policy.
And we said we would stay out of politics this hour. So I want to thank the ambassador for being here. Earl Anthony Wayne is a former ambassador to Mexico, to Argentina, and I'm actually selling his resume short. It's one of the longer resumes we've had on the program recently. A former Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs, and now a public policy fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center and co-chair of the Mexico Institute Board, and is in town as a guest of the World Affairs Council's Rochester chapter. They have him here for an event tonight talking about these issues and more. And want to thank you for your generous time, Ambassador. I do appreciate it. Thank you very much for being here.
It's been a great pleasure to be with you all.
All right, very good. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. Reminder for our listeners, Connections is always back on 9 to 11 every night, re-airing if you missed anything in the afternoon. But tonight, obviously, we're going to be live starting at 9 p.m. until whenever it takes. Election night coverage, and we have an entire team of reporters across the headquarters, across the region here, a lot of local, national, federal, state, and races. So please join us tonight on WXXI starting at 9 p.m. for election night coverage. Until then, have a great afternoon.